Hey everybody, welcome to Animanies. I'm Paige.
And I'm Chris.
And today we are going to be discussing the Cartoon Network series, codename Kids Next Door. Following with, you know, the Wikipedia, I want to make sure that none of you confuse this with CKND-DT, the Canadian television station in Winnipeg. It's very important that you know. We're not discussing the local Winnipeg TV station, but a Cartoon Network program for children.
I wonder if we actually have any Canadian listeners. I hope we do. And
that would be cool.
That would be cool. So just in case you are Canadian, we're thinking of you. We really care.
Shout out Canadians. Yeah, so this series was piloted in like the summer of 2001. They had a big event there where they showed pilots for a bunch of different shows, which is a common kind of program that Cartoon Network did in the 90s. They had a lot of like animation incubator type programming and events. So this one won that event, and it was developed into a series that premiered on December 6th, 2002, and ran until January 1st, 2008, which is a long time, for a total of 81 episodes and two TV movies. They also did a crossover with The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy. This is actually, I think, the first, like, true Cartoon Network Dark Ages show that we've done, right?
So technically that period falls a little bit later. This would have been in the tail end of that initial, what did we call it? Did we call it Gold Age?
Yeah. Like the original, it's definitely not the cartoon era. It's the era of Cartoon Network. I forget what people call it, but they name it after the interstitials, where like it shows like characters walking around in a town and like doing normal things, like going to the laundromat and stuff. So I would say though this premiered at that time. But I think it was one of the shows that kind of sustained the network through that Dark Ages era, right? Because by the time it went off the air, I think you're definitely in that era where it's like, oh my God, there's nothing, you know?
Remind me when Flapjack aired. Was it 2010? Earlier. 2009?
Let me see. 2008.
Okay, so we'd sort of discussed Flapjack as the turning point, or... Yeah, because...
Well, much discussed like, it as like a light in the dark, you know? It came before the Renaissance, and people are largely like, this was good, and this like presaged good things, but it was like during a time where everything else was trash, basically, is the way it's generally discussed.
Yeah, much like, I suppose what I would say is, I think that saying it was the dying embers of the previous age, you know, it's hard for me, looking back, is it just that I stopped being a kid in that period of time, and so to me it feels like things kind of went off the rails. I've since come to the belief that no, other people seem to have noticed the same thing. So it's not just me. And
yeah, it's, yeah.
Later, Kids Next Door just sort of faded into the background. The initial concept is very interesting, but I think part of the problem is that the conceit wears thin the more you're exposed to it. And so that, coupled with the fact that the show really, I think, taps into a child audience, primarily, first and foremost, made it less powerful. I can go back and I can watch Courage the Cowardly Dog forever. I Courage the Cowardly Dog, it was great as an adult. I think it actually was even better because I have a greater appreciation for creepypasta than I used to as a kid. So, but Kids Next Door doesn't have as much for, it is a strength and a, I would consider it a strength and a weakness that is so attuned to ages 7 to 12.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, like Codename Kids Next Door really does straddle programming eras. It really does, because like 2001 to 2004 is considered sort of like part of the sort of like powerhouse era of Cartoon Network, where they had like just like a ton of great programming, and they introduced the Adult Swim format, they just had a ton going on. And in fact, like Codename Kids Next Door was kind of a flagship program for them during that time, as the overlapping programs from the late 90s wrapped up. Codename Kids Next Door became like a flagship type programming. And then like 2004 to 2007, you end up in this time frame where it's like, okay, there's like some stuff that's going on, like Codename Kid Next Door is still on. The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, which I never enjoyed but was very popular, was still on. And then in 2004, you get both Foster's Home and Hi Hi Puffy Ami Umi premiering, and they start also airing Code Lyoko. So it's like, okay, there's like stuff, going on, right? They also premiered like Boomerang, right? And they moved all of like the Hanna-Barbera stuff to Boomerang so they could do more original programming. And like in this, in 2005 we get Ben 10 and Camp Lazlo. There's stuff that you recognize in there. They then get rid of What a Cartoon, though, which was their animation incubator, right? And they replace it with something called Sunday Pants, which, like, no one has ever heard of. So you have to wonder, like, how successful that was. And then by the time you get to 2006, the new programming that's premiering is My Gym Partner's a Monkey, Squirrel Boy, Class of 3000, and Robot Boy. and then you end up in 2007 to 2009, where, you have people like Rob Renzetti, who and Craig McCracken, working at the network, creating a different animation incubator called the Cartoon Institute, but it had clearly not had time to like pay dividends yet. Like, they canceled the Cartoon Institute, but a regular show came out of it, and so did Uncle Grandpa, which is not my thing, but it was successful, but during that, 2009 is when they introduced all of the live action reality shows, when Andrew WK was hosting reality shows on Cartoon Network and stuff, Destroy, Build, Destroy and all that kind of stuff, rather than premiering actual original programming. So that's truly, truly the dark ages. So, I would say Codename Kids Next Door is a firm, sort of silver age kind of program. It straddles it premieres during the wind down of the sort of golden age, is a flagship programming during the silver age, and ends right as everything gets really fucked up, and we have just like a dark ages before we get the Renaissance programming.
Yes.
Sorry, that was lengthy, but
no, I totally forgot that Andrew WK was involved with some of that stuff, and all I can think of is during college just songs like Party Party and
yeah,
shit.
Party Hard. Mm-hmm. Dude, our local rock radio station every Friday at 5 p.m. plays a mashup of Beastie Boys' Fight for Your Right to Party and Andrew WK's Party Hard called Fight for Your Right to Party Hard.
That feels like something a city in Iowa would do. I think there are some overarching themes that people will be able to very easily tap into when watching Codename Kids Next Door. And that proves to be a strength, but also, again, I really places it in a certain audience. Mm-hmm. And it does that from the very, like, the conceit of the show is a bunch of kids who are actually specially trained agents who fight against adult tyranny. It is undeniably a show that sees the good things about childhood and adulthood as a state of decay, and basically adults are the worst, either because they're boring, they are unfunny, they're bland, or they are straight up warped, evil, tyrannous people. There's no way to have a show with that conceit be quite as accessible to an adult audience. It even sees even teenagers are gross, pimply, cootie infected, enemies at worst and complete enigmas at best.
Well, you know, in a way, like, the thing is if you are 10, you know, and you're looking at someone who is 16, the central life motivation of getting one's dick wet is something that is alien to you, and you simply can't comprehend how that affects the decisions that you make, and so they seem inscrutable.
And I think, I suppose what I mean by that is that the show does that very well, but yeah, it makes it difficult for people who aren't children to quite enjoy it as much.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, I was watching it, and I was, like, I was just not entertained by it at all. Like, the most I got was, like, a weak little corner of the mouth twitch from, like, the whole time I watched it. I did not watch all of it because I was not entertained by it. I watched, like, probably a couple of hours worth of it. And I did not laugh out loud one single time when I was watching it. And it was interesting because I could think, I understand why I was entertained by this as a child. Like, I remember enjoying it. I'm like, okay, yeah, I remember. I think I get why I liked it as a kid. As an adult, this is just not doing it for me at all.
And maybe that's kind of maybe that's the point. I think maybe that is like a weird sort of intention to the art, is that there is something special about childhood that you can see it as a less intense thesis, that adulthood changes you. And
yeah, it's very like baby geniuses, like, can't remember that you were a genius when you were a baby. You know, Polar Express can't hear the bell ringing anymore, kind of thing. I mean, I think even part of their lore is that when you turn 13, you get your, like, brain wiped so you don't remember being a kid next door, right?
Yes, you get decommissioned, which is actually a central point of many villain origin stories, that they, like, a kid who turns 13 tries to prevent themselves from being decommissioned because their personhood is wrapped up in this really important thing that people insist be removed from you. So many villains like Number Five's sister are specifically villainous because they escape decommissioning and are bitter about it.
I just have to correct you. It's Number Five.
I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that the whole time. I refuse to do that. Because, and, you know, again, that's an adult thing, but it just, it requires me to think about saying it, and I don't want to do that. There are other things that I like about the show that are thematic, but let's go ahead and give credit to the people who made this thing. We do not get to discuss any academic lineage because this was, again, before the time where a lot of things we were seeing were in easily traceable lineages. Granted, people like Craig McCracken or Genndy Tartakovsky sort of like were, but there are a lot of people who just kind of like came up.
Yeah, definitely. This isn't, like, he didn't work, like, this was created by Mr. Warburton. You're like, Mr. Lawrence? No, not him. Patrick Warburton? Also not him. A different guy. he did character design for a couple of other shows. Like, he did production design on season one of Beavis and Butthead. He was the lead character designer for Pepper Ann, which is, I know, right? Like, Pepper Ann
totally
is like.
I forgot that Pepper Ann existed.
Yes, dude. There are a lot of, like, Disney cartoons from that era that people don't remember that are actually dope, like Pepper Ann and the Weekenders. Pepper Ann, she's too cool for seventh grade. Anyway, but that's about it. Apparently he did the creative direction for Fishhooks on Toon Disney, and was an executive producer for Muppet Babies, like the relaunch of Muppet Babies. His name is actually Warburton. That's his actual given name. His name is Thomas Warburton. He did not go to CalArts or even an art school. He went to Kutztown. So he is, like, very much kind of like an outsider to all of these other, like, lineages and, like, creative heritages that we've talked about so much in this show. And, like, it kind of is making me question myself. I'm like, are we, like, you know, being elitist in that we're kind of like doing this thing like, oh, all of these shows that actually matter were made by people that went to CalArts.
I just thought that. Literally, when you started talking about the fact that he was an outsider, I was like, oh no, are we the baddies?
Yeah, like, yeah, for real. Like, yeah, it's like, oh no, have we been wrong this whole time? Is what we have considered like a group of very talented people who, like, engage in mentorship and help other people who are very talented get off the ground, actually just a system of people who went to the Yale of Animation doing nepotism? Like, what the fuck?
Wait, okay, hold on. But let's think about this. This isn't, like, a nepotistic business major that joins a company that already makes oodles of money and can just sort of live off the work of past business geniuses.
No, yeah, they have to have their own ideas.
The proof is in the pudding.
Yeah, like being in CalArts Skull and Bones, where you, like, climb into a coffin and masturbate while holding the cryogenically frozen head of Walt Disney is just, like, not gonna, like, you know, get you a show running position. Chris is dying. His face is turning red.
Holy crap. Oh my god, that's one of the funniest things I've ever fucking heard in my life. I just really wasn't expecting it. I really wasn't expecting that. The point stands that perhaps there is... Oh, well, and this is a... when is apprenticeship not elitist?
Yeah, like, that's hard to say. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know or whatever. When you're not benefiting from it, it feels inherently unfair, right? But when you look at, like, I don't know, I look at, you know, I look at something like Bee and Puppycat. Like, I feel like Bee and Puppycat is a great example because it has not been, like, a wild success the way that something like Regular Show or Steven Universe has been. But the thing is, right, like, definitely part of the reason that Natasha Allegri was ever able to make the show at all was because she worked for Pendleton Ward on Adventure Time, right? She did, I can't remember if she was storyboard art. She did a lot of different things over there. And then he left and he created Cartoon Hangover. And he was like, yes, like, make your show on Cartoon Hangover. And it was like a very successful, like, sort of cult show. And then it took a decade for her to get her Netflix deal to, like, make it a more popular show with more money behind it. So it was kind of like that show's like a good combination of things. Like, she's clearly very talented. She clearly had connections, but it still, like, took her a long time. So I think it shows that it takes, like, talent, connections, and luck a lot of the time, you know? I mean, you know, like, even with, like, Mr. Warburton, he's not part of these, like, incredible, like, creative lineages, and he didn't go to CalArts or even RISD, you know? But he did, like, do production design on Beavis and Butthead. So, like, he worked for Mike Judge, you know? So it's not like he had, you know, like, I feel like you're on a resume. It's like, oh, he worked under Mike Judge. Okay, yeah. You know?
Is the criticism of elitism sometimes misplaced because people are sold the idea of a pure meritocracy?
Yeah, probably, because, like, the idea of a pure meritocracy is a complete lie. That just doesn't, that's not real. It doesn't exist. It hasn't ever existed anywhere, like, at any time in any society. It just can't, because that's also not how human relationships work, you know?
Yeah, I think this is part of the problem with something like nepotism. Like, by definition, something nepotistic is not a proof of quality, but it's also not an absence of that, too. In other words, it's fallacious to assume that something that is nepotistic is bad for quality or good for quality. It simply is a process by which people ensure that those close to them get opportunities. But I think things like Pendleton Ward giving Natasha Allegri a chance, that's more nepotistic than working on a lineage and using that clout to get your own show on Cartoon Network.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. That's interesting because it's like, I feel like most of us would feel like we look at it's like, oh, look, like, Rebecca Sugar works on, like, the most successful show ever in the history of Cartoon Network. And then, you know, that means at the age of, like, 23, she's show running her own show, which is, like, the second most successful show in the history of Cartoon Network, you know, and is, like, wildly popular, and they get, like, money, you know, and things like that. That seems more like it might be more unfair than, like, a guy being like, I'm doing my new venture, which is kind of like an internet network for broadcasting cartoons, and, like, there's this person I know and I have worked with before, and, like, she has an idea, and so, like, I'll give her a platform for doing that. That part feels like more fair to us, when in reality it's not. It's just that it doesn't involve a massive corporation, right? And so, like, it feels more like oh, that's the kind of connection that is like fair and normal. You know, it's a connection between you and another person in your field who is older and more successful than you. And that's the kind of connection that I feel like I can also make. And therefore, that is fair and fine for that to happen. Whereas if the connection is between you and like your bosses who are on the business side of things, not in your field, seeing your successful work in your field, and when they're trying to greenlight projects from a business perspective, are like willing to take the risk on you because they know your work, even though that is actually more likely the kind of way that anybody could get ahead, that somehow feels unfair, you know?
Well, yeah, because nepotism literally is an individual in a position of power. Like, usually it's within a family where, like, your brother owns a business and you say, come work for me, my brother. You will be my manager of this establishment. Yeah. That's directly nepotistic. So which the Pendleton Ward situation more directly matches the actual definition of nepotism.
Yeah. Yeah, because, and it's also, it's just like, you know, like when you, like if you are like, okay, there's a family in my town where like, there's a brother and he owns several McDonald's franchises. And like, he gave his younger brother one of the franchises to manage. From like an outside perspective, you're like, yeah, sure. You know? Whereas like, if you were like, whereas you say like, you know, Papa Trump like owned a bunch of real estate things and he gave Donald Trump a small loan of $1 million to begin, you know, investing in his own real estate properties. That's like nepotism and it's wrong. But the thing is if you work at the McDonald's being managed by the younger brother and he's a shitty manager, it does not feel any different. You know, it's like, it's still just like, oh my God, the owner's like shitty younger brother who can't pull his head out of his ass is like my manager and I have to fucking deal with him because like his brother owns the business. And so it's like, it is completely related to like, essentially like, not class position because, you know, there's like classes a lot more complex than that, but it is perspective related. It is related to your position in relationship to the people that these connections are happening with. And it is related to how competent they are at what they have done, right? Because usually if someone's really good at their job, most people don't care if they got it through nepotism, you know? So it's almost like, it's almost like nepotism isn't real. Like, what's really real is, like, does someone deserve what they got in terms of their competence? Because very few people got where they got purely on the basis of skill. But we all want the people who are in these positions to have skill.
Yeah, to some extent, this also comes into play where individuals want to believe that skill matters more than who you know. And and that goes back to the idea that people are sold that idea. But networking and to some extent, even these situations where you see somebody sort of benefits from the largesse of a mentor or a person in a field that's more established, that it is still somewhat, I won't say meritocratic, but it is, because that relationship is gauging soft skills.
Yeah. Like, okay, so like the whole Nepo baby discourse, right, that happened, I think is a window into this, especially for like young people, like as our society collapses and there are like no opportunities and no amount of hard work gets you anything. You know, it's like, oh, this person is a Nepo baby or that person is a Nepo baby. It got to the point where it's like, okay, so when people are like, Dan Levy is a Nepo baby, it's like, okay, sure, yeah. The first time most of us became aware of him was when he made a show with his dad. So, okay, fine. Yeah, sure. But then it's gotten down to the point where I saw the other day, Jack Black is a Nepo baby. The reason why he's a Nepo baby, Jack Black's mom was a programmer on the Apollo project, which you might recognize as completely unrelated to entertainment in any way. And like only has her being like noteworthy amongst people in her field, not household name famous. And in fact, Jack Black has brothers who are in their mom's field. I think you could maybe argue that his brothers that are in their mom's field are Nepo babies. But like, if Jack Black's a Nepo baby, that just means if you had a parent who was successful in their career and you also become successful in your career, like you're benefiting from nepotism, which is an insane thing to say. Like, that's bizarre. That's not what it means at all in any way.
Do people think that parents shouldn't help their children?
Apparently. Apparently.
That is yeah. so bizarre. This all, for me, nepotism always hinges, as you said, on the negative, where an yeah. individual is given the opportunity to continue to do something despite clearly being unable to do the thing.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
That like, is a little different. And like, yeah. if my mom knew other academics, you bet your fucking ass I would have had her connect me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, I don't understand how, like, Jack Black's mom being a programmer for the Apollo project, like, has anything to do with, like, him being successful as, like, an actor and musician. They're profoundly unrelated. It's just, like, she did one thing with her life and was good at it and was successful. And then her son did something completely different with his life and was good at it and successful. That just to me is a story of successful parenting. Like, it's just like, what, like, I don't know, like, who could she have connected him to?
To just finish up on this, because I do realize we're getting into the weeds and we've talked very little about kids next door. Yeah, we've
gone on a tangent. Yeah.
It's an interesting tangent that I think is exemplified by the fact we realize Mr. Warburton isn't an elite, as we had discussed, as much as some of the others. That even when individuals, like, even in the most sort of nepotistic situation, like Warden Allegri, come to mind, unfortunately, it is the fact that whenever people have to make decisions about what to fund or what to give mm-hmm. a chance, people mm-hmm. will prefer individuals that have proven themselves at least once before. And this
exactly.
This is also true in romantic relationships. People find mm-hmm. people currently in relationships more attractive. And that's not because everybody is, you know, horny to be a homewrecker, but that is because individuals in relationships now are successful in mm-hmm. a relationship, at least in getting a relationship. So just like that, if you've got an individual you've worked with before, you mm-hmm. even if they're maybe not the best, you know demonstrably the quality of their work. That allows mm-hmm. you to make a better prediction about how that will turn out. So people may even be willing to accept that, you know, maybe this isn't the best animator in the world, but I know what they're capable of, and it reduces uncertainty in that decision. And that is a
because it can also
thing.
Work. Like, it can work in the negative, too, because if, like, the same situation, like, all things equal, two different people, two different animators you're going to hire, right? One of them is new to your company, and one of them has worked on another project at your company before, and you look at their performance reviews, or you talk to their, you know, showrunner or whatever, and they did a shitty job. Like, you know, they're difficult to work with. They make excessive, unbased reports to HR. They're late on their deadlines. Their work is sloppy. Like, any of these kinds of things, you'll be like, well, let me not hire that person because they have a proven track record of being a shitty employee. So I'm going to take the risk on the unknown, because the known is I know they're going to do a bad job, you know? It's asking too much of human beings to, like, not take that kind of information into consideration when they make decisions. That's just not how, like, decision making works. But anyway, we got off on a weird tangent with that. I did not expect that. That's very interesting. But we have a similar kind of thing going on throughout this show where we have some really big names, but other people are like sort of more like journeymen, like actors, you know, or like relative newcomers. So, you know, Mr. Warburton is the creator. There aren't any co-creators listed. There's not anybody listed as, like, you know, like a big, you know, storyboard director or anything like that. It was directed by Mr. Warburton. He was also a head writer. So it was really like he was really heavily involved with that. He didn't have a lot of outside crosstalk. The executive producers, none of them are names that are super familiar from other stuff. They don't even, all of the executive producer names, none of them are even like a Wikipedia link. And even when you get down to the voice actors, it's the same kind of situation. So, you know, we have our main characters, numbers 1 through 5, right? All 10-year-old children. And we have, two of them are voiced by a gentleman named Benjamin Diskin, who is just a guy, you know, like, I don't recognize him physically. I don't recognize his credits. Like, it seems like he's done a fair amount of both live action and voice work, but not really anything that stands out that much, you know? We've got somebody else who's voiced by D. Bradley Baker, who is, you know, he's like a real, like, journeyman voice actor. He has credits on all kinds of shows that you know, but it's all like, you know, minor characters that you can't really place, or it's just listed as various characters, you know? He's actually really well known for doing animal voices, which is interesting. Then you have Lauren Tom, who, like, she was in the Joy Luck Club.
Mostly live action credits.
Mostly live action, yeah. She was Ross's Asian girlfriend in Friends. She was in the Joy Luck Club. Apparently she was in some episodes of Supernatural. I'm having trouble. Oh, she was Kevin's mom.
Yeah, Kevin's mom. Fucking
from Supernatural.
Kevin's mom is one of the better performances of those middle seasons.
Yeah, for real, yeah.
It kind of like drags a little.
It does a little, but I love Kevin and his mom.
Yeah,
great.
Kevin and his mom are both great. Yeah. In those seasons where they're trying to get the tablets and all that fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
Oh man, don't get me started on a Supernatural hole, because and then nobody will be fucking surprised by this. Who do you think voices the young African American girl on the team? I'll give you a second. Give you 5 seconds to think about it.
I don't know. Who is it?
It's Cree Summer. Of course it is.
It's Cree Summer. Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's like, it's interesting because we've talked before about how Cree Summer, like, she doesn't show up as much as you would expect her to show up, like, after the 90s, basically. But her voice is just so distinctive. Like, it's, that, you know, like, gravelly voice, right? It's super distinctive. It's great. It sounds super cool. And so, you know, she, as soon as you hear Number 5 talk for the first time, you're like, oh my God, it's her, you know? So she's a big, big exception to that.
Okay, so a lot of the other people that show up as guests, regardless of the character they play, because people often pull multiple voice duty, But some of the more famous people will realize is Billy West has a role. Jennifer Hale has a role. Tara Strong has a role. Mark Hamill has a role. So we've got Tom Phil Kenny, Lamar. Phil Lamar, Gray Delisle.
A lot of like OGs showing up for, you know, just like, you know, guest roles. Oh, I do remember Sticky Beard, actually, looking back. That's Mark Hamill. He's the pirate with his beard is full of like lollipops and stuff. In case anybody was wondering, because I did not immediately recognize this name, Billy West is like, he's Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny from Space Jam. But he's also Doug from Doug, you know, and a lot of other, like, he's Fry, he's Farnsworth, he's Zoidberg, he's Zap Brannigan. Like, if you watch, like, Matt Groening stuff, like, you've heard his voice a lot. So he's a real OG. He just hasn't done as much work in, like, children's animation. And so he hasn't really shown up for us, right? Oh my gosh, he's the Honey Nut Cheerios bee. Or he was until 2004.
Since we're talking about voice roles, I do have to say that there was something that was very jarring, which was Number Five's father is impersonated in a Bill Cosby voice.
Oh dear.
And clearly his father is their father is inspired by Cliff Huxtable, because they wear the Argyle sweater, and they talk into this and then the that and then the this and then the that.
I go to the kitchen to get the chocolate pudding.
Yeah, so it's weird in a time where
now we know he's one of history's greatest monsters.
And it's it's just weird because people, I think they were spoofing the Cosby Show more than they were Bill Cosby himself, but still, it's weird that's just a weird thing that's happened in the last 20 years.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Yeah, it's just like, I think if we have like any listeners who are more than 5 years younger than us, that's something that they like maybe don't like get. It's like up until approximately 2015, like Bill Cosby was America's dad. Like Bill Cosby was like this super wholesome figure who like made all kinds of stuff and everybody loved Bill Cosby. Nobody had a negative word to say about Bill Cosby. He was truly beloved. And most of us had never heard those rumors. Like, those were rumors that went around in entertainment circles, but, like, most ordinary Americans had not ever heard those rumors until, basically, like, Hannibal Buress started using them in his stand-up routine, basically.
I'm going to really try not to get off on another tangent, but something that's fascinating to me is the nature of parasocial relationships. And the internet age has... the information age has really shown us that people are not especially equipped to deal with seeing people they are in a parasocial relationship. And I know that, like, there's a distinction between relationships people used to form with celebrities and parasocial relationships, which people are more familiar with forming in streaming communities, OnlyFans communities, places where individuals are, you're spending hours and hours of time with people and they are cursorily, they are somewhat aware of your presence and can occasionally interact. But the formation of these social relationships where people feel strong ownership and defense of a person that they aren't actually friends with. And Bill Cosby if like his trial evokes such a reaction in so many people who felt the need to defend America's dad because they'd formed this image of him as being this wholesome figure for them and to them. And you see this shit with people who make shows that people really like. Like, people were like, no, Justin Roiland is not a shithead. Because they really
like... he also one of history's greatest monsters, it turns out.
Like, people... If people really like a property or a streamer or something and they form this weird parasocial relationship with them, people have a tendency to treat them less like a person and more like an image of a person, neglecting the idea that these are people and people are awful. People have the capacity to be awful people. And show business attracts some of the best, but also a lot of bad people, partially because the industry is not successful. People in the industry are often bad people because the industry encourages bad things, but also just because, you know, people are people and narcissists gonna narcissist. So if you're forming a parasocial relationship with somebody, It is hard but healthy to assume that person is a person and they have flaws. So don't be surprised when you hear somebody you like does something shitty.
Yeah, it's also one of those things where it's like, it's important to like understand that like information is revealed to people over the course of time for like understanding the way that people are referenced in like media products that were made before we had that information. Because, like, you might, if you're, you know, 20 now, you might see an impression of Bill Cosby in Kids Next Door and be like, what the fuck is going on? Like, this is dark. What is going on? What were they thinking? What they were doing? And it's like, most of us didn't know that then. They were thinking about, like the Cosby Show was still on Nick at Night, like, every day. And Bill Cosby was America's dad. Cliff Huxtable was like an archetypical, like, firm but understanding dad, where like as a family, when there were problems and when the children were struggling, you know, they would sit down and Dr. Cliff Huxtable would talk it out with his son, you know, about what was going on and what they were gonna do, and they would share their feelings. And Dr. Huxtable would be understanding and they would come to a conclusion as a family, right? And that kind of like positive understanding, you know, like close, warm relationship between a father and son is being spoofed here, because this is a show in which like adults are literally the enemy. Right. So like, of course, like number one has a dad who's like Cliff Huxtable, but number one is like a higher up in an organization. What?
Number five.
Oh, number five. That makes more sense. You know, like number five, like, right, like is in this organization, but she has a dad who's like a Cliff Huxtable type, you know, but like, you know, she's not gonna engage in that, right? Because she's like, no, adults are the enemy or whatever. So it's in that context, like that's the context, and it's important to know like that's what they were doing there, and like they didn't know. Well, they didn't know.
same thing with like people didn't start, I think, rumblings about Harvey Weinstein, for example. You know, had permeated through show business for a while, but people didn't really start openly making comments or jokes about it until like the late 2000s.
It's the same with Louis C.K. It's like people who were in comedy had been talking about it for years, but, and that's also what's really important. That kind of breaks down that parasocial relationship. Like, you do not know these people. You do not know the people who know these people. Like, you are not in any way a part of their industry, their friendship networks, or nothing. So when people, when, you know, women who move in the same circles are warning each other about these things, it never gets to you, right? Because they're intentionally not letting it out because of the potential consequences to themselves. And so, of course, you don't know, right? And it didn't used to be, there didn't used to be Twitter. Like, there didn't used to be a whole culture of you would publicly be like, this guy showed me his dick. Like, that didn't exist. So when people are like, how could people not know? It's like, well, people did know, just not the general public, because why would we, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I actually just, you actually made a good point. I've never considered that before the internet, I think parasocial relationships were especially, were a tool used by, still are a tool used by stand-up comedians.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Like, because, and also they, well, because stand-up comedians get up on a stage 5 feet away from people and they like do crowd work and like you can get heckled. So you have to be like more personable and be able to deal with that. So you have like a lot more like FaceTime with your fans than like an A-lister does.
And they tell you stories that you think are about their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Whether they are or not. Yeah.
Forgetting that it's probably a bit.
Like, yeah, or it's like, it's like part of it, it's based on something that happened to them, you know, but it's not.
In my experience, I connect the most with comedians who get me to suspend my disbelief about mm-hmm. something that happened in their lives. They make me feel like, no, they're actually being honest about something that happened mm-hmm. to them. Even though I know in the back of my head that that's 9 times out of 10, likely not what happened, it still helps me connect with them.
100% believe everything John Mulaney has ever said about what has happened in his life.
I actually do too. He's usually pretty, I mean,
he's so believable. I don't know. I totally believe that old guy said, too old to be a duck now, quack, quack, and like pounded his cane. I completely believe that. Like, maybe it didn't happen that way. Probably it didn't happen quite like that. He probably phrased it in a way that's a little funnier than what actually happened. But I've never questioned anything that he has said for a second, you know?
So, Kids Next Door, making us go off on tangents because the actual show is less dense.
Yeah, it's like a tangent engine.
Kids Next Door, as a show, here in our 52nd minute.
Oh my God.
Okay, here's the deal. Both of us did not enjoy Kids Next Door as much as we did as children. And I think that goes to the central thesis of the show, which is childhood is special. And you lose something when you grow up. And the main antagonists of the show are teenagers, adults, or senior citizens. And its view of all of those things is bleak, like very bleak. Like adults mm-hmm. are basically destined to become curmudgeonly, overweight, grotesque beings.
Yeah, I mean, like, here's the thing is, like, what I happened to miss just in the random episodes I chose, especially because a lot of the episodes I watched were from season one. I missed most of the adult villains. I missed most of the lore. I missed most of the teenagers. A lot of that did not show up for me. So a lot of what I saw was just, like, heavily focused on like the kids next door themselves and their relationships with each other or their relationships with other children. And I was like, these kids fucking suck. Like, these kids are entitled little brats and somebody needs to punish them. Like, it's like, you know, like the first time that you see the delightful children from down the lane, the context is they are having a birthday and the kids next door show up to steal their cake. It's explicitly stated, like they do every year. And they said, like, and like number one says, we would rather the cake be destroyed than see you snobs eat the cake by yourselves and not share. And it's like, I don't, not share with you. They have other kids at their party. Like, do you mean not share with you? Because I wouldn't share with you either. You guys are being dicks. Like, why are you stealing these other kids' birthday cake? That's not nice. So I'm immediately like, yeah, I understand why you're in a conflict with these other children and why they want to fuck you up, because you are fucking their shit up all the time, you know?
To be fair, the show does have a pretty dense mythology for the show that it is. the Kids Next Door is a global organization of children that are basically also trained as spies, secret agents, combatants, etc., that specifically counter the machinations of adult tyranny. And really, adult tyranny is alive and well in the show. There are actually adults that are abusing children in a variety of ways. One example comes to mind of a villain who makes soda illegal to consume under the age of 13.
Oh my God, Michael Bloomberg is in this show?
It's a show. It's a show where that episode parodies Prohibition. In fact, number mm-hmm. two shows up to a soda speakeasy. But the whole conceit is that the adults want the soda for themselves because soda can only be truly enjoyed by those with a refined palate. So not only in that episode is soda being stolen from children, but children are being shoved into soda bottles so that they can age into adults without causing trouble. There's some
it's also like
wild plots in this show.
Yeah, but it's also that very much that child perspective of like, why are adults doing things that I do not like, right? Because it's like, you're a child, you're at the mercy of adults. They can just do like whatever, basically. And even when they explain themselves to you, you just like don't process it, you know? So you're like, why would adults keep the soda away from me? Because they want it all for themselves. Not understanding, there's a functionally infinite supply of soda in the world. And they're keeping the soda away from you because you really don't need that much sugar. You know, it's just like, you're making me do chores. The only reason that you had children is so that they could do your chores for you. And like, you just don't want to do your chores. It's like, no, like your adults are making you do chores so that you like know how to do them when you become an adult.
Or there's an episode where ice cream trucks won't stop for kids because they're hoarding all the ice cream in the world so they can have a giant adult-only ice cream party. That turns out to be a plot orchestrated by the delightful children from down the lane. But yeah. Ultimately, what's interesting is the show clearly makes a divide between the Kids Next Door, crazy adults, and then literally everybody else is normal. So you've got adults like the Candy's parents that are normal people. They have normal jobs. They react normally to situations. They are otherwise normal people. There's an episode where the Kids Next Door interact with a dentist, and the dentist is a normal guy, but the villain of the episode is a dude who failed to become a dentist and sells candy and attacks kids at night with dental implements as the night dentist. And
that's a great name for a villain, actually. That's terrifying, the night dentist.
It was like the night something. I don't remember.
I'm sure.
The night dentist. But basically, the dentist is a normal guy. He's like, you know, you guys should come for an appointment. And all the kids, of course, laugh at him. But that's one of those cases where you're like, as an adult, you're like, dude, you're going to rot. You're actually going to have lifelong dental problems because you're eating all of this candy unsupervised.
Brushing teeth, dude.
It's like an exaltation of the child's perspective that just, again, makes it hard to access for adults. Now,
yeah,
this does present interesting things that I really like. We didn't have, you know how everybody is like, okay, there's like cottage core, grunge core, like that core.
Everything like out completely outside of music now, everything is a core or punk, which is very weird for me from someone who like was in that type of musical subculture. I'm like, cores and punks are for music or for cyber something, right?
The Kids Next Door describe all of their tech as 2x4 technology. I would describe it in the modern era as treehouse core.
Well, I feel like, okay, like treehouse core would be more of like a design aesthetic for your home. Whereas, like, I feel like treehouse punk is more of like an artistic,
oh,
like artistic or technological
you're
thing.
Right.
Yeah.
This is treehouse punk.
Yeah, it's treehouse punk, not treehouse core.
Or 2x4 punk.
Yeah. Yeah, radio flyer punk.
Where that episode of Futurama where Bender becomes a wood robot. I don't know if you've ever watched Futurama.
I've watched a lot of Futurama, but that one's not ringing a particular bell.
So, yeah, this is 2x4 or treehouse punk. That's good. Because, like, they create lasers with mustard bottles.
Which is fun, because, like, that as an adult is fun, because you're like, oh, like, yeah, like, the conceit here is that it's, like, actual technology, but, like, you know, it's really what it is it's the power of information, imagination. Like, you're a child, anything can be anything,
well,
you know?
Well, but then they strap wood to a decommissioned F-16 jet. Like, I'm like, where are they getting shuttles and trash compactors? And, like, where are they getting all these actual adult pieces of technology? But that's the fun, is, like, you can imagine a kid taking a toy space shuttle and, like, mm-hmm. super gluing shit to it to make
yeah.
it into, like, a mech.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's actually kind of fun to think about Kids Next Door from a perspective of, like, this is actually all, like, make-believe. You know, like, there's no moon base, there's the treehouse is normal-sized, like, they do not have access to an F-16, like, it's actually a model plane, you know, like, all that kind of stuff, and that it's all actually just make-believe. Like, that's a fun, like, way to think about it, you know?
The show also has some good villains, too, along with, like, its make-believe. A lot of the villains are figures in a child's life that they could use their imagination to zhuzh. For example,
yeah.
There's Count Spankula.
Count Spankulot. So fucking weird.
Who is a full vampire, by the way. An actual
like the fucking
vampire.
Count from, like, he's straight up purple, dude. With fangs. And the accent.
He spanks bad children. Other people's bad children.
Dude, I, like, in the few episodes I watch, I encountered him. What happened is number one goes away and doesn't turn on, like, the alarm system, basically. And just immediately, he breaks into the treehouse and is like, children who don't pay their library fines need to be punished or whatever. And spanks them all and then leaves. It's so fucking weird, dude.
Like, the villains are, just to name a few, the Common Cold, who's a dude who gets people sick by shooting snot at them.
Gross.
Supermom and Mega Mom and
Destructo Dad,
who are basically just overbearing parents with mechs with, like, super suits. There's Father, who is arguably the main arch enemy of the K&D and is actually kind of scary. He's a black figure. He's never really shown outside of a silhouette, and he's
truly a shadowy villain
wreathed in fire and is actually a bastard. He's the father of the delightful children from down the lane who actually kidnapped them from the K&D, brainwashed them, and is now their abuser. So that's pretty dark. But other villains are like the crazy cat lady who has too many cats. The like Sweet Beard, who's a Sticky Beard, who's a pirate who steals candy from children. The Night Dentist, Mr. Boss, who is the boss of many of the parents of the K&D and wants to do things like shoot kids to the moon. So their parents will have to work 24 hours a day. Because the only thing keeping parents from working 24 hours a day are their children. Which
yeah, or like even like
kind of based anti-capitalists, perspective. For real, yeah. Where the boss is a villain because he is a corpo who wants to make all of his workers work and not spend time with their children. So pretty great. He comes up many times.
Yeah. Or like I even see one here that's called Grandma Stuffem, and she's an old lady who wants to force feed children her disgusting food. So they get so fat they can't move and they don't bother adults. You know, that makes me think about like my great grandparents. Like I remember visiting my mom's grandparents occasionally when I was a kid, and I remember very distinctly like associating meals eaten at their house with like casserole that was very nasty. Like I just remember there was casserole and it was nasty. You know, so it's like, and like there's any number of reasons why maybe it was like that. She was old and didn't really remember how to cook anymore. It was like an older style of food that I wasn't used to having. Like, we didn't eat casseroles in my household because my mom doesn't like casseroles. But I very much associated my great-grandmother with nasty-ass casseroles. Or one time I woke up in the night and she was awake and she asked me if I wanted warm milk and she made me warm milk, which was weird because I'd never had warm milk in my life outside of that time. And I was like, oh my God, it's like from a book. And warm milk is also gross.
Warm milk is gross. Without any
it's
other,
not good.
Without any other flavors in it, it's just not great.
It's not good. Yeah.
It's interesting to think about how a lot of the villains theoretically could be considered misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I don't know, like Mr. Fib and Mr. Wink are common villains, and it's actually... as an adult, I actually felt very bad for them because although they are, you know, kind of annoying, they basically like used to be children and then they went through puberty and like went bald and all this other stuff and sort of just like had to be adults, which sucked. And now they're reviled by the kids next door. And yeah, they do try to do things like create a forever Adult Swim. But one way to read that is that adults want to just not interact with kids sometimes, and that kids are like, how dare you?
Yeah, it's like, I just want to go in the fucking pool for a minute and like lay on a pool raft without some kids like splashing me and trying to drown me and like screaming and screeching and hitting me with a ball. Is that too much to fucking ask? Is that so much to ask? Adult Swim is like 15 minutes long.
Kids are selfish and the kids next door really extols that.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely.
But it also makes it
they're really
accessible.
Little brats. They really are.
So we've reached a decent amount of time here. And I feel like we went on so many tangents.
We really did.
I think that that in and of itself is valuable information for our experience with the kids next door. I think it's interesting and fun. And there's some stuff that you can say about the visual style and the mythos and all this stuff. But I don't know. It really is a show for kids, and mainly a show for kids. It's really one of the first we've run into where I got the feeling that it was mostly just not accessible for adults.
Yeah, definitely. And also I was like, oh, the animation looks bad. Like they clearly didn't spend a lot of money on it or whatever. The one thing actually that I was noticing that I'm like, number three, kind of racist, maybe.
Yeah. Kuki Sanban is Japanese and she talks in what is colloquially called English.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just in case those of you aren't aware, Japanese does not have L sounds.
Yes.
The
closest they have is an R.
Yeah. The language uses R R sounds, and they're usually like pretty hard R's, but there's really no L. So the only way to really mimic it is by using an R sound with your tongue.
Like a clipped R, yeah.
And so when, you know, people who are Japanese learn English, the L sound is particularly difficult to get right. And people exaggerate it for comedic effect a lot of the time, which, you know, and that's kind of what Kuki does. So
that, yeah, and like also like just like her, she doesn't like have like eyes.
Yes, they are always closed.
They're like always like slits. And also it appears that Kuki is in fact a real Japanese girl's name, but also I feel like it does feel kind of like an Asian name joke, because like her personality is kind of kooky, you know? Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it feels like I feel somewhat uncomfortable actually with this. At least she was voiced by an actual Asian person.
Like, that
and not a white person.
That's the only thing that made me feel okay with it. The only
for real thing. Like the only thing I was like, when I was looking, I was like, okay, it's not just like completely like unforgivable because they actually had an Asian actress, but like yeah, I was like, this is not. She was also extremely kawaii.
Yes, and super into like super rainbow monkey. Like, very...
She loves stuffed animals.
She loves stuffed animals. But, yeah, we didn't really talk about the individual characters much either.
They're because not much character, you know? Like, and they also are kind of stereotypes in a way that is kind of, like, racist. Like, there's the, like, ultra-kawaii, kooky Asian girl. There's the, like, super cool, athletic black girl. The fat nerd. This is not exactly racist, but, like, the, like, rageaholic Australian guy.
Oi! What are you saying to me?
Yeah, it's, like, that's absolutely an American stereotype about, like, Australian people, is that, like, you know... They're like aggressive and angry,
on a criminal continent.
In a penal colony. All of their ancestors are criminals.
Sounds like a place I could visit. A penal colony.
God damn it. Chris. And then also like Nigel, he's British. And so he's like cool and like smart and like in control.
Bald as a child. Yeah, they're all very caricature-ish.
Yeah, and like they rely on like racist and xenophobic stereotypes actually for their characterization, which I did feel a little bit uncomfortable with. Yeah.
So, kids next door, we are moving. We're getting our U-Haul and we're moving away from the kids next door.
Not in with our brand new girlfriend that we just met. We're not lesbians, so.
Yes, I can confirm I am not a lesbian.
Yeah, so I don't know. Like, if you feel like you want to watch Kids Next Door, you can do it with the Boomerang add-on for Amazon Prime. That is a legal way to access it. I honestly really can't recommend it. Like, maybe if you have kids, you know, and they're, like, running out of shows to watch, or the shows they're watching you find, like, just profoundly annoying or something, you want to put that on for them. But I just, like, I don't know. Just, like, as an adult, I'm like, probably won't be that into it.
I would put it in the category of shows that are just going to be better in your nostalgia.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely better to, like, remember, oh, yeah, I loved that show, than it is to, like, actually watch it as an adult, for sure.
We did the work for you. We bear this burden for you.
So you don't have to. So you know. Yeah. Yeah, but that's about it. I mean, like, I feel like this is the least we've ever had to say about a show. Like 90% of this episode was tangent.
We may have said less about Doug.
You know, I spent, like, a long time talking about, like the end of the Cold War and Francis Fukuyama and, like, how Doug encapsulated that view of the world.
But that wasn't really about Doug as much as it was about how we hate Francis Fukuyama.
Yeah, fair enough, yeah.
So, yeah. This mm-hmm. has been Animates.
I've been Paige.
And I've been Chris.
As always, we're on social media, Facebook, Animates Podcast, Twitter, at Animates. We can be emailed at gmail.com. It's Animates with the numeral 8 instead of the letters A-T. We once again, after 6 years of making this podcast, futilely beg you to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast so that others may find it. But for those of you who are here, as always, thank you for listening.